ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Everyone's got to eat. And sure, some of us like chips, but others like to grab live animals, stick them in a mucus tube, and nibble at them while they're still alive. This is What the Duck, the podcast that has snuck into Mother Nature's kitchen to see what she's cooking up and found that, well, perhaps actually this isn't to our taste. It's under-seasoned and it's still wriggling. Seriously though, the ways that animals grab a bite to eat is pretty darn fascinating, and of course you can find a million books on how we do it on sourdough starter or sous vide your meat or activate your almonds, but trust me when I say this, we humans are not the weirdest when it comes to catching a meal. I'm Dr. Ann Jones, and everyone's got to eat.
Chris Elgin.
Hey, Chris, it's Ann.
Hey, Ann, how are you?
I'm good. And some of us have got to dance for our dinner. So, I sent you an email before that was titled Stoats Are the Goats.
When just chasing doesn't get the job done, the creature turns to an unexpected superpower.
Look, I was intrigued. I was intrigued, you know, that Ann Jones, what have you got for me?
The stoat on the hunt will go nuts.
Could the stoat, a weasel found across the Northern Hemisphere, actually hypnotize a rabbit by wriggling his little belly?
Spinning, jumping, interesting. The stoat closer and closer.
The internet says yes, like in this video called Stoat Hypnotizes Rabbit from the Nat Geo Wild YouTube channel, the veracity of which I intend to review and critique immediately.
But the rabbit remains transfixed until it's too late.
So that's why I've called up one of Australia's most senior mammalogists.
I'm Chris Elgin, and I'm the chief scientist of the Australian Museum.
Yeah, and he has much better things to do than talk to me about rumours of stoats literally wriggling and spraying around like they've got a spider on their back in order to hypnotise a rabbit into submission. So, is the internet lying?
And this will take us down a little bit of a rabbit hole, which is, of course, literally where the stoat hunts. So people know a stoat is a weasel, right?
It looks like an even cuter version of a ferret. Tiny. Males weigh less than 300 grams. They're smaller than a polecat, but larger than a least weasel.
It's a pretty small animal, but it's like all members of the weasel family. These things can eat small mammals up to things that are a heck of a lot bigger than them, whether that's like a rabbit or a decent-sized bird. So they are incredible hunters.
So they can kill rabbits, but do they do it by hypnotizing them through dance?
And I think you're going to love this, that it's actually called, even in zoological circles, the waltzing weasel. Although there's a lot of disagreement about exactly what's happening. In that video you showed me, the idea was that it was doing this dance and that was drawing the rabbit in, right? Maybe. That might be a thing. But, you know, also, we know that weasels do this in other circumstances. Is it an expression of joy? Is it play? Is it just being frisky? So it may be that it's just sort of an incidental thing that weasels are doing this.
So the stoats might be having a grand old time letting loose and then, a rabbit is admiring my choreography. Might as well help myself to a little lunch.
But there are a few other thoughts. Another one is that, and I think you'll like this too, that it's more of like a victory dance. once a stoat has nailed something and then starts its waltz, but then, you know, maybe like in football, like they're spiking the ball after the touchdown, maybe that's what it is. The one that I think is probably most likely, and this is really out there, but it's really a thing with stoats. So stoats often have a worm infection in their heads.
In their heads?
A parasitic worm, a nematode, lives in the heads of weasels like stoats. And so it's a common parasite. And one of the things that zoologists noticed really early on in looking at the skulls of all kinds of members of the weasel family is that they've got all this damage at the back of the nose where the nose ends and the brain starts. These worms literally wear away the bone, squeeze the skull, and put pressure into the brain. And so if they have a really bad infection, this can affect the behavior of weasels. And it's one idea is that, you know, maybe stoats are going a bit mad and they're jumping around. This is a pretty common infection and it affects their brain.
Oh, that's incredible.
So down the rabbit hole, right?
That's down the rabbit hole. This, you know, all of these little films that have been made that are like, yes, this is a trap set by the dancing stoat as it wiggle wobbles its way into, you know, to the death machine.
To be honest, when I watched that video, I'm sure you must have noticed it too, is, you know, the rabbit is approaching and we never see the stoat and the rabbit same frame.
No.
And then when it grabs the rabbit, it's about half the size of the one that was supposedly approaching. Yeah. It's totally a different rabbit.
Yeah, welcome to natural history television. It's, you know.
Exactly.
I am a bit sad, though, that the stoat dancing trap, like a siren calling in the ships, is probably not a real method of getting a meal. But I did read a paper from the early 2000s about the margay, which is an ocelot that is arboreal. It lives in jungles in South America. Apparently, scientists recorded it making the sound of the monkeys that it preys on.
Right, like mimicking the sound really well.
Yeah. But then, you know, my cat makes that sound, the ek 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 sound, when it's looking at a blowfly. So
maybe it's a lot smarter than you were thinking, though. Maybe, you know, maybe it's setting that trap.
No, she's named Bubbles, and the reason she's called Bubbles is because there's not much in there.
Gotcha.
Wait. Side note. I actually want to know, does the cat make those ek-ek-ek-ek sounds because it's trying to lure birds in with an oral trap? Is this aggressive mimicry? Okay, I'm going to call a cat person.
Hello, Julia speaking.
Hi, Julia. This is Anne Jones. Julia Henning is a PhD candidate at the University of Adelaide, and she's studying cat play. So what is the ek-ek-ek-ek?
That is a great question and one of the ongoing mysteries of cat behaviour. We've got a few ideas, but we just haven't tested them yet.
Okay. There's all these theories on the internet, right, that are like, oh, this is the cat trying to call in the birds. It's trying to speak bird.
So before we all scoff at that suggestion, there was actually a study done that looked at a wild cat in a jungle.
I know this. It's the margay.
Yes, that's correct. And what they found was that this animal was actually mimicking the sounds of its prey, which was a specific species of monkey. Cats do a lot of things very similar to their wild ancestors. They're really quite close to being wild themselves. So if one cat species does it, it could be very real that our cats are trying to mimic bird sounds.
It is heard in other species too. The Australian spotted katydid mimics the call of its prey cicadas. It calls like the male, and the females come over looking for a relationship. Instead, they get served as dinner.
The other one is that it's just an instinct. So like their tail flicking or like us, you know, laughing or crying, it's just something that they can't control. This is part of getting excited about hunting. But the truth probably lies in a mix. It's probably something to do with hunting behavior, something to do with instincts.
Okay, so it turns out that cats aren't necessarily trying to use aggressive mimicry to bring the prey closer. Julia says it could even be them trying to cover the noise of their own movements. But we need to do more study. And whatever is going on with the ek-ek isn't getting in the way of them being an absolute ecological menace and eating birds left, right and centre, is it? So truly, you cannot trust the internet for anything. So who can I turn to for advice on weird methods to get a meal? Oh, wait a second. I've actually got the head of science at the Australian Museum, Chris Helgen, still on the line. So does the idea of like animals using traps, does anything else spring to your mind?
I think of mostly outside the mammal world. I think of, I don't know, like an antlion grabbing stuff from its, you know, underground hideaway.
That's exactly what I was thinking too. If I think about animals setting traps, I'm thinking about things that are sort of more physical rather than psychological, like the cat with its ek, ek, eks. And I think there's an example right here in the shed under the car. Here be lions.
So it's like a funnel.
I've managed to find someone who is even more into these little lions than I am.
Yeah.
Inon Scharf is an associate professor with Tel Aviv University, where he studies, among other things, ant lions. When I was a kid, I was always a little fearful of whatever was under the sand in those little indents because, well, they sounded dangerous. Surely they don't call it a lion for nothing. It turns out it doesn't even have a mane. So what does an antlion look like?
Like all insects, it has three parts, body parts, so a head.
Which is super puny.
A thorax.
It looks like a stooped neck on the antlion.
An abdomen, like a belly.
The beefiest bit, shaped like an almond. And these three bits come together to make the antlion look like a slightly mouldy weevil fossil with a dowager's hump.
So I think the most important body part of an antlion is the strong mandibles.
Like a massive set of sharp tongs.
With these mandibles, it pierces the prey and it sucks its fluid content.
It sucks the fluid out of the prey's body, sort of like a spider does with its prey. But it doesn't use a web. It builds a trap from the ground itself. They start in the centre and they use their mandibles to push the sand out in a circular motion until they're buried at the bottom of an inverse pyramid.
It can take them an hour or even more to dig a pit. And this is why they tend not to leave it after it's constructed unless they have a good reason to leave it.
Wait, so how long do they actually live under there?
So only the larval stage digs the pits. And they can live long for, let's say, antlions, I think even 2 or 3 years.
Well, as larva? Wow! Where you see all those little traps on the ground is sort of, I don't know, it's the equivalent of the caterpillar stage of a butterfly. It's when they're antlion babies under there. And they can be trying to murderize ants for maybe 3 years. But what do they turn into as adults? Lace wings. Gorgeous, slight little insects, skinny bodies, long antenna, translucent winged little angels.
The adult is quite disappointing.
Rude.
Because after 1 or 2 years, so the adult lives maybe 2 or 3 weeks. They don't eat a lot. They are really bad flyers. So the adult stage is disappointing after this voracious larvae. So, yeah.
So the larvae in those traps spends their time doing home maintenance and laying in wait without food for long periods. But then, within seconds, it can rev up and kill the equivalent of what would be for us an angry, bitey antelope.
They only walk backward.
Okay, this is becoming a list of weird shit about antlions now.
They lost their ability to move forward, so... And this, I guess, it's an adaptation because they dig themselves into the pit or into the sand.
But that means at the bottom of their pit, right, they can't jump forward to capture the prey. They patiently wait and wait for the ant to struggle its way all the way to the bottom.
When the ant falls into the pit, they start throwing sand on it.
Okay, so not so patiently wait.
They bombard it with sand. And then the ant falls further inside the pit, and then they can grab it. Yeah.
The antlion is playing dodgeball with the prey, which is simultaneously also trying to climb up a sand dune with an incline of over 45 degrees.
Yeah.
It's got no hope.
Yeah. And unless the ant cannot put one of its legs out of the pit, so there is no way to get out. You know when it can get out? When the pit is wet and then the sand gets really hard and it's like walking on concrete on a slope, and then the ants can get out.
And that is why, of all the places at my house where the antlions live, it's in the open-sided shed under the car, because with any moisture, their traps would become less trappy.
You know, another good question is why there are so few animals that construct traps in nature? And I don't have a good answer. Because we know that a lot of animals use tools, right? So why not using traps?
Well, there are animals out there, but the ratio of animals which build traps to animals which use other hunting methods is skew-whiff. There are ants which lay out feathers on the ground, and then mites come along and go, "Oh, awesome feathers." And then they get pounced on by the ants. It's sort of like a bait or a lure. Oh, there's the alligator snapping turtle, which has a lingual lure. They sit with their mouth open and they wiggle their tongue. It looks like a worm, and then, blammo, the snapping turtle snaps its jaws down on a curious fish for breakfast. Probably the most obvious and the most famous and perhaps the most sophisticated of all traps are those of spiders. They make all manner of webs, orbs, funnels, big tops, stretchy nets that they throw out over prey. But there is one creature that's stuck in a dark hole that sets a trap of incredible complexity. It is the stuff of nightmares, especially if you don't like snot.
Oh, okay. Well, glowworms, many people don't realise it, but they're immature flies.
Oh, David Merritt is an entomologist who studies the sparkling, shining, bioluminescent, predatory, trap-building glowworms. Should that be glowflies?
The adults are very short-lived and very people ever get a chance to see them. But they fly around there like a big mosquito. They don't glow or anything like that.
Gah. Adulthood is so lame.
The larvae, the immature stages, they can't survive without their web.
Yeah, it's not a fly getting caught in a spider web. It's a fly with her own web. I love that for her. But anyway, what does a glowworm actually look like?
It's about the length of a matchstick and about the sort of thickness of a matchstick or smaller. And it's very transparent body. It's sort of slimy. They're totally adapted to living inside this mucus tube.
It does sound like something you'd yell at a sibling down a hallway. Get out of your mucus tube.
Yeah.
It's truly a thing of beauty. The glowworm itself lives in a suspended slime tube hanging sort of like a hammock, and it's from there that it constructs a web, which is not like an orb spider web. Oh no, it's way more globby.
They'll spend hours just sticking their head out of the tube, lowering the front half of their body down, and then their body starts doing these pulsating movements and they spit out a droplet of mucus, which they hold on their end on their mouth. And then they release some silk slowly and that droplet goes down a bit, say a half a centimetre or so. They spit out another drop of mucus and more silk, more mucus, more silk. So you end up with these long lines in caves. The lines can be the length of your forearm. They don't have just one, but they can have 70 to 100 or something like that. And anything that flies into that just gets trapped straight away. Oh, it's snotty and slippery.
What actually happens, though, when an insect is captured?
Well, that insect, they end up sort of covered with this mucusy substance and silk.
Oh, like a honeymoon. Oh, my God, I can't put that joke in.
Now, the glowworms are very, very sensitive to anything in their web, and they'll go and check it out straight away. They go along their mucus tube, and then they'll hang their head out of the tube and start hauling up the line that the insect is on.
Like bringing in a fishing line, sort of.
And they swallow the silk line and the mucus that's on it as they're doing this. So they just haul it up slowly. It can take some minutes for them to haul an insect up. And they'll then stick it into their mucus tube so that it won't get away. And then they just start feeding on it, even while it's still alive. They just start chewing away at it.
Nature is metal. But there is one extra special element that increases the trap's efficacy, something that spiders don't do.
Well, up until recently, it wasn't really known why insects fly to lights. You know, everybody assumes, you know, moths are attracted to lights. That's an easy thing to say. But why? And it turns out that they're disoriented by the light. The light makes them tip sideways. And because of that, they end up flying in circles around the light until they run into it. Well, it's the same sort of thing that glowworms are manipulating by producing light in an otherwise dark environment. If you go into a cave and you look up at the cave ceiling, it's like a constellation of stars. And any insects that emerge from a stream inside the cave or a puddle or whatever, they don't know that they're in a cave. They're just insects. They're not that clever. But here, because the glowworms are copying the stars, this same thing happens, that the insects, as they fly, they want to keep the glowworm constellation in the same location as far as their eyes are concerned. So they end up going on this curving flight and running into the glowworm's silk trap.
It is really impressive, using your own snot plus inner glow to attract lunch. But I want a trap builder, like a human trap, you know, like a snare or a hole with leaves over the top. I want
teeny tiny ants.
Yeah, I want teeny tiny ants. We've absolutely saved one of the most complex and weird ways to get a meal to the very last. Associate Professor R.J. Narendra is a neuroecologist at Macquarie University, and he's agreed to talk to me about a discovery made in the Amazon about 20 years ago.
But then they started noticing something really bizarre. Winged insects started landing on the plant. They started noticing that these insects couldn't move anymore and they were being killed.
It wasn't carnivorous plants, though they do entrap insects for a meal. It was tiny ants called Alimaris decimaticulatus.
The ants have gone in the plant and they have trimmed off a whole bunch of these little hairs which are on the plant, but they've left a few.
In between the hairs that they'd left, they build a sort of pergola.
And I think the way they've done this is by chewing all the food that they eat, and they have regurgitated it.
They make a cement from their vomit.
That's not all. which it gets even more bizarre. These ants encourage a type of fungus to grow on these plants.
The ants are fungus gardeners. It's like they're encouraging a grapevine up over their pergola. And in the surface of that little roof, there are holes. And in every hole, there's a tiny little ant face looking out, waiting.
What the butterfly does not know is that as it's approaching, there are these tiny little predators who are waiting there with their mandibles or the mouth parts wide open to catch them.
Yeah, like mouth open, ready to chomp.
So as soon as these large insects now land, and these little ants with the mandibles wide open are now going to catch hold of whatever part is actually accessible through these tiny holes.
The ants then move along hole to hole, stretching the prey out along the branch. They maximize the surface area available to the ants to bite.
It is truly bizarre. And the mandibles are connected to glands which produce specific toxins. And in addition, these ants also have a sting on the rear end of their body.
And at the same time, they send out a signal.
We've got something. And that means now there is a whole army who all rush out.
Hungry sisters on the way.
And then they slowly sting it.
Yeah, death by a thousand stings. These ants are tiny, tiny, tiny little things compared to their prey.
Cut them into relatively small bits, and then they gradually move it back home.
So they dismember it.
Literally.
Oh, God.
But the cool thing is that all the insects they're capturing is actually not for themselves. It's to help the young ones to get enough protein.
So all of this trap building is so that their young ones can develop properly into adults.
Absolutely.
Oh, my goodness.
So it's a very altruistic way of thinking about it. It's actually not for themselves. It's for the betterment of the entire colony. It's truly remarkable.
Wow. Maybe we need to stop thinking about our own last meal and how we're going to get our next meal and how yummy it's going to be. And we need to start thinking more about the entire colony and how we can feed all of our members. Such are the life lessons from teeny tiny ants. This episode of What the Duck was produced by me, Anne Jones, and Patria Ladgrove and Belinda Smith on the lands of the Wadawurrung, Woiwurrung and Kaurna people. And if you are hungry for more, see what I did there, Make sure you head over and follow or subscribe to What the Duck on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. I'd really appreciate it. Oh, shit. Do I still have Chris on the line?
Absolutely. Well, thanks, Sand. Great to talk.
Catch you later. See ya.
Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.